Well, good morning. What book are we in? Romans. At least you got that part down. Chapter 5. John last week looked at the first five verses of chapter 5. We're going to be going through verses 6 through 11 this morning. You notice I entitled the message, Once Saved, Always Saved. Fact or fiction? Most of my adult life, in fact, most of my total life, until I came to this church, most of that time was spent in Baptist churches of one flavor or another. And every church, not just Baptist church, but every church kind of has their distinctives. You know, something that they are known for, it seems. And Baptist churches are no exception. And in the South, you don't just have Baptist churches, you have lots of different flavors of Baptist churches, right? And most of my Baptist involvement in churches was in Southern Baptist churches who were often accused of believing this, once saved, always saved. And, I mean, they did believe. But they were also accused of it. And that's not just acknowledge that you believe it, but accused of believing it. And, you know, I've had conversations with people over the years, and you know, they find out, you know, you have Southern Baptists who believe in eternal security or once saved, always saved. Supposedly you have, I think, missionary Baptists would generally fall in that category as well. Independent Baptists generally fall in that category as well. And then there are other Baptist churches that don't believe in it. Free will Baptist churches do not believe in eternal security or do not believe once saved, always saved. General Baptist churches do not teach that as well. So you have these different kinds of churches, one are in one camp and one in another. So as I was growing up in Baptist churches, I might speak to a friend of mine or somebody or have a theological discussion with somebody who's, say, a general Baptist, and they would say, well, I guess you believe in once saved, always saved. And how do I answer that?
Yes.
Yes. And then the next question that they come out with is this. So you think then that somebody can be saved and just do whatever they want and die and still go to heaven? Now that's a question that I've been asked that a dozen times, I guess, and I just can't answer it with one word. You know, technically, the answer would be yes. But there's so many things that you feel like need to be qualified in that answer. Now, last week, John preached on the first five verses, and in those verses, there were some statements made in the text and in his sermon that just stated the fact. Since we are redeemed, since we are saved, since Christ has died, we have peace with God. And it's just stated as a fact. Okay? There are no conditions put on it. There are no qualifications to that peace. It's just stated. And there are a multitude of verses throughout the New Testament that just state that fact. Or stated as fact. And this morning, there's another one. But in our text this morning, Paul presents this as a reasonable argument. Now, this text this morning is not a text that is generally used to as a proof text for once saved, always saved. Okay, now there are other terms that I always hated to use that term. There are other terms that are a little more technical. Eternal security is a term that you have probably heard. Preservation of the saints is another term. Perseverance of the saints is another term that is used generally to refer to these things. So, what is it that Paul references this morning? We're going to look at these verses, 6 through 11, and see what they say. So let's begin by reading verses, our text, Romans chapter 5, verses 6 through 11. He says, "For while we were still helpless," or some versions may say powerless, "at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will hardly die for a righteous man, though perhaps for the good man someone would dare even to die. But God demonstrates his love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Much more then, having now been justified by his blood, we shall be saved from the wrath of God through him. For if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his Son, much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. And not only this, but we also exult in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have now received reconciliation." If you have an outline, you see the first point that I'm making this morning is this, that it is unreasonable to expect to be saved at all. It makes no sense that God would save you. You. It makes no sense that God would save me. And Paul illustrates that with this illustration. He says it's hard, it's a hard thing to do to find somebody who would be willing to die for somebody else, no matter how good they are. If we were to have a law in our country that when someone is put on death row and they're to be executed, and the execution date is set. But in our society, it's not this way, but let's imagine just for a moment. In our society, let's say that they had a 1 week period prior to the execution date where the citizens of the state of Arkansas were given the opportunity to volunteer to die for that person. And next Sunday, there's the execution date for some man. He may have been a bad guy at one time, but he's a changed person. God has changed his life. And we know that. It's a known fact. And I come to tell you today, next Sunday is the execution date for this good man. And there's a sign-up sheet in the foyer for all those who would be willing to die in his stead. We dismiss church, go home, and I go get the sign-up sheet. How many names you think are going to be on it? None. None. Probably. We are reluctant. We don't just casually volunteer to die for somebody else, do we? We don't. And Paul is saying, that's a hard thing to do. Scarcely will you find somebody who will die, volunteer to die in the place of someone else. It's hard, he says, to find that for a righteous person. But how much more difficult, is his illustration, is it if the person is not so lovely? If there were, next Sunday was execution date, and there was some vile man who had committed all kinds of heinous crimes, and he was unrepentant and he spewed his vile and his vulgarity at every opportunity he got. And I tell you, the opportunity is there. There's a sign-up sheet in the foyer. Even less likely is there someone who would volunteer there, isn't it? Now that's the comparison that Paul makes. Let's read it again. Verse 7. For one will hardly die for a righteous man, though perhaps for the good man someone would dare even to die. But God showed his love toward us in that, what? While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. You see the comparison there? You won't find very many people who die for righteous men, but God has done something different. Even while we were vile and wicked, even while we were unlovely and ungodly and unrighteous, while we were sinners, Christ died for us. God has done something that you would not expect him to do. That is the illustration that Paul is making in those verses. Everyone follow the illustration. Okay, so my question then is this. What is it about my relationship with God? What is it about your relationship with God? What is it about anybody's relationship with God that makes it unlikely that God would save them? Two things. The first one is this. It's the state of man in sin. What is it like that you are really a sinner? First thing. We're guilty. Is anyone in here not guilty of being a sinner? Didn't think so. We're not innocent. We're guilty. And if God were to pronounce judgment on us and condemn us to hell for no other reason than the fact that we're guilty, could you charge God with injustice? No. No. Guilty. That's enough. That's enough. That's the state that we're in. We are guilty. But our condition is worse than just being guilty. We're also powerless. Verse 6, we saw that word, for when we were still helpless. Now that helpless is a weak word. Powerless is a little better word. Some verses say without strength, which is very similar to powerless. What does that mean? When we were powerless, when we were yet without strength. And we know it has nothing to do with our physical strength. It has something to do with our ability. What have we been looking at as far as man's predicament and man's nature these first five chapters? Man is at enmity against God. Man despises God. Man suppresses the truth that he knows about God. And that's where we're at here. When we were yet without strength, when we were unable to do anything about our guilt, because we didn't want to do anything about our guilt. We were suppressing the truth that we knew about God. when we were in that condition, that is the condition that we are in, just being men. So yes, we're guilty. But it's worse than just guilty. It's guilty and we don't have a desire at all to do anything about our guilt. But our condition is even worse than that. This text says, for when we were enemies of God. What is an enemy? If I have enemies, how do you think they feel about me? They hate me. They don't like me. They don't want to see any favor come to me. Right? This text says, at one time we were enemies of God. Now I want to read a portion of something from this book. This is The Holiness of God by R.C. Sproul. I want you to listen to what he says. He's quoting initially from or mentioning a book that Jonathan Edwards wrote, or a sermon actually. Probably the most well-known sermon of Jonathan Edwards was Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. You probably heard of that. Jonathan Edwards preached another sermon that was entitled Men Naturally God's Enemies. Back when Jonathan Edwards was preaching, their titles were a little more, I don't know what the word is, stoic or descriptive, but not descriptive that us watered down people can grasp easily. Okay, a little more technical, blunt, technical, hard to grasp. And R.C. suggested that perhaps a better title for that second sermon or book would have been, and he's playing on that, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, so perhaps a better title might be God in the Hands of Angry Sinners. All right, here's what R.C. says. If we are unconverted, if you know someone who is not a Christian, an unbeliever, one thing is absolutely certain. We hate God. The Bible is unambiguous about this point. We are God's enemies. We are inwardly sworn to His ultimate destruction. It is as natural for us to hate God as it is for rain to moisten the earth when it falls. Now, our annoyance at what you just heard may turn to outrage. We heartily disavow what I have just written, he says. Can you see that? I can see that. I hear what he's just read, and I say, I don't see the world that way. I don't see a world of unbelievers who hate God. I know unbelievers that it doesn't look to me like they hate God. He goes on and says, we are quite willing to acknowledge that we are sinners. Who isn't? We are quick to admit that we don't love God as much as we ought. Are you quick to admit that? I would. I would admit I don't love God as I ought. But who among us will admit to hating God in our unconverted state? And he references this text in Romans 5. For if, when we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to Him through the death of His Son. He says the central motif of the New Testament is the theme of reconciliation. Now listen to this sentence. Reconciliation is not necessary for those who love each other. Is that right? That's right. Reconciliation is not necessary if I love you and you love me. God's love for us is not in doubt. The shadow of doubt hangs over us. It is our love for God that is in question. The natural mind of man, what the Bible calls the carnal mind, is at enmity against God. We reveal our natural hostility for God by the low esteem we have for Him. We consider Him unworthy of our total devotion. We take no delight in contemplating Him. Even for the Christian, worship is often difficult and prayer a burdensome duty. Our natural tendency is to flee as far as possible from His presence. His word rebounds from our minds like a basketball from a backboard. By nature, our attitude toward God is not one of mere indifference. It is a posture of malice. We oppose His government and refuse His rule over us. Our natural hearts are devoid of affection for Him. They are cold, frozen to His holiness. By nature, the love of God is not in us. As Edwards noted, it is not enough to say that natural man views God as an enemy. We must be more precise. God is our mortal enemy. He represents the highest possible threat to our sinful desires. His repugnance to us is absolute, knowing no lesser degrees. No amount of persuasion by men or argumentation from philosophers or theologians can induce us to love God. We despise His very existence and would do anything in our power to rid the universe of His holy presence. If God were to expose His life to our hands, He would not be safe for a second. We would not ignore Him. We would destroy Him. This charge, R.C. says, may seem extravagant to you. It may seem irresponsible until we examine the record of what happened when God did appear in Christ. Christ was not simply killed. He was murdered at the hands of malicious men. The crowds howled for His blood. It was not enough merely to do away with Him. But it had to be done with the accompaniment of scorn and humiliation. That is an enemy. When we were enemies of God. Now that sounds a little extreme. I want you to think about what the Scriptures say. Is there a middle ground for either you love God on one end or you hate Him on the other? Listen to the Scriptures. Romans 8:4. I can talk about this much because we'll get there. Because the carnal mind is at enmity or opposed to God. For the carnal mind is not subject to the law of God. Listen to these words. Neither indeed can be. James chapter 4, verse 4. Know you not that whosoever will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God? One thing or the other, James says. You're a friend of the world. If that's the case, then you're an enemy of God. Matthew 6:24. No man can serve two masters. For what? He will either hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. But you can't have it both ways. Matthew chapter 12, verse 30, Jesus said, "He who is not with me is against me. And he who gathereth not in scattereth abroad." The New Testament seems to consistently place our nature at either or. You can't ride the fence. You can't be neutral. We might say, "Oh, you know, people aren't that bad." Jesus said in Matthew 23, a scathing chapter. If you want to read a scathing sermon, read Matthew 23. Jesus said, talking to the scribes and Pharisees, "You scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites, for here is what you say." First of all, he says, "You adorn the sepulchres. You adorn the tombs of the prophets." We do that. Dead people who were made an impact on the world, after they're dead and gone, what do? We honor them. We talk about how great they were. They were wonderful people. And their tomb is in the, you know, Washington, D.C. or wherever it is. People know where it's at. And they're looked up to. And Jesus told them, he says, "You hypocrites, you adorn the tombs of the prophets from old. And here's what you say. If we had lived in the day of our fathers, we would not have treated these prophets the way they treated them." You reckon? Jeremiah was thrown in a well. Elijah and Elisha were constantly running from their life from Ahab and other kings. And yet Jesus' contemporaries said, "Not us. If we had been in the days of Elijah, we'd have been right with him. We would acknowledge Jeremiah as a great man. Isaiah is a great man." Jesus said, "You're lying. You hypocrites, you varnish their tombs, you shine them up, and you say, 'Not us, we wouldn't have done that.'" Jesus said, "You're lying. You're a hypocrite." In his day, it wasn't the prophet that they killed. It was the Son of God. Chances are excellent if all of us had been walking the streets of Jerusalem on that Friday and the week before that Jesus was crucified. Chances are excellent that we might have been in the streets with them, yelling, "Crucify him. Crucify him. Do away with this man." So, what is it about our relationship with God that makes God saving us so unlikely? That's what it is. It's because of who we are. Why would God save us? Why would God save you? But there's a second thing that makes it unreasonable and unlikely. And that's the stand of God against sin. God is a holy God. God is a just God. That is His nature. That is an attribute of God. That's the way God is. God is a just God. And sin must be dealt with for justice to be carried out, for God to be just. And that's the way God is. God is just. And God will not just let it go. And secondly, God is angry. We don't like to talk about that, do we? Psalm 7:11, God is angry with the wicked every day. That verse doesn't say God's angry at their sin, does it? God is angry with the wicked every day. We talked before in chapter 1 about this anger and this wrath that is God's settled disposition, that God will, His wrath will be carried out, it will be sent to its end, its just end. Now that makes it unlikely that God would save anybody. So, your sin, my sin, is a stench to God Almighty. God hates it. God doesn't ignore it. God will not overlook it. God will not justify it. God will not sweep it under the rug. God will not just say, smile and say, well, boys will be boys. No. No. God will not let you blame it on somebody else. God will not let you blame your sin on your mama or on your daddy or on your ex-spouse. No. God comes to you to talk to you about your sin. You are the sinner facing God's wrath. It makes no sense to expect God to save you. It makes no sense to expect God to save me. But God showed His love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. God has done what I would never expect Him to do for me. Now, that being said, here's Paul's argument. If that's the case, it's a reasonable thing to think that God will keep me. It's a reasonable thing to think that God will keep me. Look at verse 9. Here's some key words. Much more. All right? I'm not sure if some other translations may use different words there. Most of them use those two words. Much more than. If this is what God has done, much more than, I can confidently expect something else to take place. What's he say it is in verse 9? Much more than, having now been justified by His blood, we shall be saved from the wrath of God through Him. You see what Paul is saying? If God has done the unreasonable thing, if God has done the unlikely thing for me, it makes sense that He would keep me. It makes sense that He will save me from the wrath of God that is coming. That's his conclusion in verse 9. Verse 10, he explains it. For if, see at the beginning of verse 10, notice what he says. Now this verse 10 is a complex sentence. It talks about two attributes of God that are woven into the same sentence with two different contrasting ideas. Now let's listen to what it says. For if, when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of His Son, here's those two words again, much more. having been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. Now there are two things that Paul is comparing. The first one is me. Two things about me. One is when I was God's enemy. And the second thing about me is he's comparing when I am reconciled. So he's comparing when I'm his enemy to when I'm reconciled. So notice those two comparisons and look at it again. For if, when I was his enemy, I was reconciled to God by the death of his son, much more now that I am reconciled, I will be saved by his life. You see the contrast. He says it's encouraging to think. It gives me confidence to see after what God has done in saving me to start with, if he would save me when I was his enemy. It's reasonable to think that now that we are friends, now that we are reconciled, now that I love him too, he will keep me. I will be saved from the wrath of God. The second thing he contrasts is something about Jesus. It's, on one hand, it's Jesus' death. On the other hand, it's Jesus' life. The first one is this. He says, if God could save you by dying, if Jesus could save you through his death, he's dead. Don't you think he can keep you because he's alive and seated at the right hand of God? If he was able to save your soul on a cross, dying, surely he can keep you at the right hand of God. Is that what the text says? Keep those things in mind. Paul is giving us his thinking here. For if, when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his son, much more then, being now reconciled, he says, we shall be saved by his life. So Paul comes at this subject, the subject of being eternally secure in God, the subject of always being God's child. And he comes at it through this reasonable argument. All right, that's a little different approach than what we typically use to debate this topic. But we see, at least, I'm encouraged to think this. Does Paul believe in once saved, always saved? It sure seems like it. It seems like it to me because of his argument. It seems like that he does. So, what response should you have? What response should I have as I think about what God has done? What God has done in saving me? What God has done and the confidence that you can have, that I have, that he will keep me? The response is, he says in verse 11, we have joy. Our hearts are filled with joy and gratitude. I remember years ago having a discussion similar to this with a guy. I saw his face just light up. He said, it makes you want to say, why me? And that's exactly what we ought to say. Why me, God? Why me? You know, as I've talked to people who are friends of mine, and I'm not bashing denominations or such that would not teach this doctrine. But if you were to ask them, what is it that you could do? What are the circumstances could there be that you would lose your salvation? Or fall from grace is a term that's used. So. And generally, you can put them, and from my experience, you can put them in two groups. One is sin. And not just small, insignificant things. Not just get aggravated and mouthing off to your spouse. Not that kind of sin. Big sins. That is a big sin. That's a big mistake, is what that is. Big sins. The Catholics call that mortal sins. There are certain sins that people would say that you'll not be a Christian anymore. You'll lose your salvation. Murder. Adultery. Although they may have mark that one off the list, I'm not sure. All these kinds of things. So that's one group, sin. And the second group is unbelieving. I just decide it's not true. I don't believe it anymore. And so you lose. Now let's look at both of those things and see really what's at stake here. If I retain my salvation because I don't commit any of these mortal sins, the first thing that is involved there is that I am watering down what is really sin. Because there are lots of sins that are not that big, but they are still sin. They are still sin. They still make me a sinner. These little small things, I'm still guilty of them. And here's what I think is implied. And someone would probably disagree with this, especially from those camps. But the thing that I would say that could cause me to fall from grace is really the thing that keeps me in grace, at least the ability to refrain from it. If committing a murder would make me fall from grace, then not murdering keeps me in grace. In other words, and you can make it be whatever you want, but if there is sin that keeps me from falling from grace, then not sinning keeps me in grace. And that is works. That is being saved by my own merit. What about this second thing? Believing. Someone believes. We call them a Christian. Someone acknowledges all the right things about theology or the necessary things about theology, and they are a Christian. At some point in their life, they decide, hey, I don't believe that. I don't believe there is a God. You know, whatever it is, they renounce that. So we say they fall from grace. Let's look at that. Think about that just a little bit. What is it to believe? We talked about the definition of faith, of the definition of believing, the biblical definition of believing a few weeks ago. You remember? First of all, it's facts. You got the facts right. Secondly, you have the intellectual ability to understand the facts. And thirdly, is a proper and a fitting and a reasonable response to the facts. It's one reason James says, you believe there is one God? Good for you. The devils also believe and tremble. You believe there is one God? There's the fact. There is one God. Number two, do I understand that? Yes, I understand that. I understand the implications of that. Number three, I respond reasonably to those implications. Someone like demons refuse to respond in the right way. That's a little, won't go into the implications of all that, but at least they tremble. We have implications of our faith. And our implications are to submit ourselves in obedience to God. For the person who supposedly falls away, who quits believing, what do we say about that? And here is where, especially in the South, maybe it's everywhere, I don't know, we're in the South, so I know it's in the South. There are a multitude of things that people will take as acknowledgement of professions. I know someone that I love dearly in my family that I have never seen a person die who did not go to heaven in their view. No matter who it is, no matter what their life was like, they died, they're in this better place. Reckon? Is there anybody, I want to ask them sometimes, is there anybody you know that might not go to heaven? Lots of people have prayed this little nice little prayer. And we've proclaimed them Christian. But this third part of faith, you never see it. And the older they get, they might have been 3 years old when they prayed this nice little prayer. They might have been 6 years old when they prayed this nice little prayer. But as they get older and older and able to not be under mama's thumb, daddy's thumb, and mama's, what do you call it? Curtain strings, apron strings, or whatever it is, whatever the saying is. When they're able to show what's really in their heart, it's lacking. More than likely, it's not falling from grace. It's just that we see there was no grace. So, do I believe in once saved, always saved? Yes. The key is on once saved. Once really, really, really saved. Not just one mouthing a few words. Can a person who is saved just do anything they want? Yes. And still go to heaven? Yes. The qualifying is anything you want. When you get a good dose of Jesus, your wants seem to change, don't they? All right? Doesn't mean we never sin and all this after we're saved. But as a general rule, our hearts are compelled to come to God, to love God, to obey God. Yes, we fall. Yes, we sin. Look at Abraham. We talked about Abraham a week or two ago. God was leading Abraham. God was carrying Abraham and promising Abraham something. But in the midst of all that story, there are two or three things about Abraham we didn't talk about. His doubts. He went to Egypt, told his wife, "Don't say you're my wife. They'll kill me. Say you're my sister." I made her feel good, right? All right, we're weak. Yes, we're weak, but inside there is something inside that is different. God has saved us. God will keep us. Let's pray. God, I thank you for the confidence that we can have that we are your child. And God, that what you have begun in our hearts, God, in your own time, in your own way, God, you will see us to the end. God, help us to love you more. God, help us to not fall into the trap of thinking, of presuming upon you. God, give us a love that grows, a love that grows day by day, a desire that grows day by day. Change our hearts, conform us to the image of your Son, so that all the world may see that we have met Jesus. Amen.